to John Swinfield's Big Business Podcast. And now, let me introduce your host, journalist and writer, John Swinfield.
Hello, I'm John Swinfield. Welcome to Big Business. I'm a journalist and television producer, and I've spent much of my life writing and making films about business bosses. I hope you find this pod gossipy, irreverent, informative, and even fun. If you like the feed, please don't forget to click the subscriber button. Big Business is on every week at 11 a.m. GMT on Wednesdays. As I look back over the years, from surveying a carnival of personalities, Victor Gottborn, an American trade union boss, stands out. He featured in a one-hour film which I made with a talented director, David Lloyd, of the BBC. The film was called New York Debt City. We made it for the Money programme on BBC Two. It was the 1970s and the first time I'd been to America. Its pace and urgency excited me. As well as making the film, I sent dispatches back to George Scott in London, the quietly distinguished editor of the BBC's now long defunct and still missed Listener magazine. Years later, I did the same for Peter Fiddick, formerly of The Guardian, when Peter became the editor of The Listener, sending in stories about the impoverished and the dispossessed in Latin America and Southeast Asia, where I was also making films. I am privileged to have made films and to have seen at close quarters both sides of humanity's coin, from the powerful to the penniless. America has always beguiled me. I've been on many occasions since that first trip, sometimes for extended periods. At one time, I thought I might live there, but I have only known it really as a filmmaker and a journalist, passing through, staying mainly in hotels, with usually, thankfully, somebody else picking up the tab. As a resident, I might have had a different view. The restlessness of New York always strikes a chord with me. It's a cliché but true that New York never sleeps, and New Yorkers seem rarely sated, as if always searching for something more. I find a resonance in the Big Apple's fizz, its teeming, perpetual sense of discontent. I'm rather the same, sadly. It's not especially admirable, and it doesn't make one happy. It's just the way it is. Maybe it's journalism. One is quickly bored, always looking into the next field, forever imagining it's more exciting than where you are, or what you're doing. New York had gone bust. Roads, rail, education and welfare were on their uppers. Police, fire, ambulance, hospital, sanitation and garbage workers were in danger of not being paid. The city was in meltdown, its collapse characterized by a gaping hole in a forsaken, elevated highway, through which a truck had pitched, hanging in midair, helpless and abandoned. There was no money to salvage it. The wounded highway, the suspended truck, a tragic motif for a city in despair. New York was suffering the agonies of a billowing crime and murder rate. The South Bronx was toxic, a narcotics-riddled battlefield of burnt-out tenement blocks. The police only ventured there in platoons. Predator gangs of black and Hispanic youths dealt drugs, lit fires, and rang for the fire brigade to mug the firemen and to steal their equipment. The middle class had fled to more secure neighborhoods, white flight. Because of how the revenue system was structured, they took the tax base with them, leaving city coffers bare. In place of the affluent middle class came the destitute and the workless, pouring into the city, trying to claim benefits such as they were. New York's plight was apocalyptic. Its survival depended on being bailed out by Washington, its near neighbor. But Washington's patience had expired. Its munificence had topped up New York's begging bowl once too often. This time, it wanted to see it suffer and would resist its cries until it was almost in its death throes. The Washington consensus was that New York had been mismanaged for too long. It condemned it for spending money it didn't have, for being too big, too flash, vulgarly ambitious, fiscally out of control, a brash, racy metropolis, all front and no knickers, profligate instead of prudent. Too often it had taken the easy way out by giving in to the exorbitant demands of its municipal workers. As I did the rounds of Washington and Capitol Hill, the climate more urbane and measured after the Big Apple's mayhem, talking to politicians and economists, I sensed jealousy about New York, the city that reached for the sky and was now on its knees. It's what New York engenders. It's too showy for its own good, too glitzy to have any real friends. Back in New York, Victor Gottbaum was big, broad-shouldered, bull-necked, and fiery. He had a distinct menace about him. Hard as granite, an unyielding nightmare with whom to negotiate. One who had to was Abe Beame, the English-born, pint-sized mayor of New York. Beame was wily, gutsy, and tenacious, half Victor's weight and height, but equally combative. Rhodesian Ridgeback versus Snappy Terrier. Gottbaum represented New York's essential workers. Without their willingness and his consent, the Big Apple was in danger of going rotten at its core. Victor Gottbaum was never daunted by opposition. He had a view of the world, and he stuck to it. There was an explosive moment in the film when I was interviewing him. He unexpectedly brought his massive, hirsute fist crashing down onto his desk. Pens and papers jumped into the air. He'd lost his temper about something or other, incandescent about a mountain of injustices that he felt were being heaped on his members. Eventually, and perhaps inevitably, New York's political, business, and trade union masters began to see sense, reluctantly modifying their demands and inching towards each other in a messy, uneasy truce. It was in the nick of time. New York had become almost a war zone. The fancy boulevards of Manhattan would be stained with the violence which already gripped its less chic suburbs. Begrudgingly, Washington would start to loosen the purse strings. A barrier preventing a settlement had been the multiplicity of unions with which City Hall had to negotiate. Gottbaum brought 58 unions into line, banging their heads together, forging them into a representative body of more than 100,000 municipal workers. I will never know if Gottbaum was corrupt or in the pocket of the mafia, though many thought so. He certainly looked the part. An archetypal, hard-eyed union boss, strutting and confident in his impeccably cut Italian suits in midnight blue. He seemed, for all the world, untouchable. Chisel features, massive chest, shoulders like an ox. His New York drawl, as thick as the swirling fog on the Hudson. Burning anger in his dark eyes, a cold temper in his stare. Gottbaum's world was brutal and unforgiving. In New York, at that time, a glittering seam of wealth ran parallel with poverty. Later on, making films in South and Central America and in Southeast Asia, I became more familiar with the fabulously rich and the desperate, utterly impoverished, living within a champagne cork's trajectory of one another. In New York City, for each preppy financier in a Brooks Brothers button-down shirt and grey flannel suit, striding confidently through Manhattan like one of Tom Wolfe's Masters of the Universe in his mordant Bonfire of the Vanities. There were huddles of the dispossessed, up from Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. At each corner loitered dark-eyed hoodies, sullen and menacing, running junk. American trade unions were largely in the pocket of the mob. Bribery, corruption, revenge beatings, and contract killings had become endemic. Gottbaum invited me for lunch. We swept off to the Italian Quarter in his chauffeured car. Long black bonnet, black windows, a stretch limo so long those in the back seemed to arrive some seconds after the driver. We glided to a stop at a small, old-fashioned shop, lace runners framing its window, trays of fruit and veg spilling onto the sidewalk. His minders had bull necks, black suits, black shades. We threaded our way round sacks of fruit, edging round the counter into a small, shadowy snug, warm, private, windowless. Two chairs in crimson velvet facing one another at a small dining table. A gaudy crucifix pinned to the wall. This, then, was Victor's lair, hidden at the back of a fruit and veg shop. An Italian New York mama greeted him like a son. "Victor, Victor," she murmured, hugging and kissing him on both cheeks. A gargantuan bowl of steaming pasta for Victor and I to share, chunks of hot, newly baked bread, thimbles of grappa downed in a gulp, more Barolo than I had legs for, and in the air a trace of moist fruit and veg drifting in from the shop. Victor's anger made him articulate. Labour disputes, the mob, Beam, City Hall, all the cronies, the chasm between Wall Street and the workers. "New York's in two halves," he told me. "My people and those they work for. We're the world's richest country with some of the poorest people. You know what would happen if it wasn't for my people? This city, this grand city, would break down. There'd be riots, bloodshed. There'd be no Big Apple left to argue about." When I left, one of his bodyguards took a green apple from a sack, examined it carefully, polished it on his trousers, and then lazily bit into it, wiping the juice from his chin. "Victor's your man," he said, fixing me with a gaze I couldn't see, his eyes hidden behind black shades. Outside, the driver of the stretch limo was still at the wheel, half asleep in the heat, the engine ticking over, air conditioning on maximum. On his lap, the New York Daily Post, a picture of a bloodied corpse on its front page, gunned down in Queens in a drug deal gone wrong. The furnace heat of a late New York afternoon. I tried to remember where I was staying. You've been listening to Big Business. This is John Swinfield signing off. Don't forget to click on subscribe. I'm on every Wednesday at 11 a.m. GMT.